Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Room, which is, of course, our interview series as part of the Clone Star Pod. I am your host, Sean Ferrick, and joining me is the supremely talented voice of many of the characters you didn't even know she was the voice of. It is the amazing Dr. Una McCormack. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
Well, you know, I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm always very happy when people call me supremely talented. That's always cheers me up. It's better than the other thing that people have been using lately, which is veteran writer, which I think...
Oh, my goodness.
I know, it makes me sound like, I don't know, Maggie Smith or something. Very grand, some kind of grand dame of... tie-in fiction.
it's funny, it's like, you know, kind of, I'm sure the first person to say it was like, I know this will sound really nice and it's going to be meant in the nicest possible way, and then these things have a way of just like snowballing and you're like, well hang on, we're like, no, don't say that. So I tell you what, I'm never going to use the word veteran in any way.
Good.
Around you, okay?
Or geriatric. That was
Right now, at the beginning of your career as a writer, you know, kind of, because so do you have plans to write about Star Trek or anything like that on this day one of writing for you?
Absolutely not at all. Cool. So I guess what I was writing was, I was writing a lot of Blake Seven fan fiction sort of tootling about online, doing a lot of Blake Seven fan fiction. And then it was on mailing lists, so all the fan fiction kind of moved online. This was the mid-90s, so it was very exciting. We were on mailing lists. Wow. And then I watched Deep Space Nine and got very, very traumatized by the end of it. Kind of end of Cardassia. So I just started churning out stuff posting it online, and it was getting kind of nice reviews. It's all very, you know, community and relaxed, all this sort of thing, using my own name, which I don't think many people do, but you know, just didn't think I needed a pseudonym, which worked out quite well, because I've told this story many times, but as a result of my fan fiction, I got contacted by the editor of the Book Strange, the Star Trek Book Strange, Marco Palmieri it was at the time, and he said, you've been recommended. There's a Deep Space Nine anniversary coming up, I think 10 or 15 years, can't remember. Would you like to pitch? Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be fantastic. So absolutely no plans to do it at all. I mean, I enjoyed doing it. I did it as a hobby. I was busy doing a PhD in sociology at the time. 2005, I wrote up my thesis and I wrote my first full-length DS9 novel, which was Hollow Men. And I don't recommend that.
Immediately downloads Hollow Men.
Yeah, at least one of those had to go through significant rewrites, and it wasn't Hollow Men. But, okay. You know, I got away with it, which is more than my PhD supervisor thought I could do. So, you know, a big thumbs up there. Yeah, so that was day one, and sort of day maybe 500. But yeah.
That's actually funny, because we recently had we had a quick chat with James Swallow as well, and as part of our interview, he ever so gracefully cursed your name. He said, it doesn't happen that way. People don't approach us to write for. So he said, look, you know, you are quite literally one in a million. This is it's amazing, really, how it came about.
We've done a lot of panels together, and I tell this story, and Jim immediately goes, look, what you've got to understand is this doesn't happen. Yeah, it happened to Una, but it doesn't happen. And there were all sorts of things going on. I think I was lucky that there was an anniversary coming. I think the show was off air, so it was, with the best will in the world, it wasn't a kind of premium franchise, not like when Picard came back. So there wasn't a lot of competition for slots. There's quite a lot being produced, and the editor had the luxury of looking. He was just in a position of looking for new voices. I was in the right place at the right time, and my writing had just got competent enough that I was, you know, you could commission me and not go, oh God, what have I done? So lots of things, but most of all, it never happens except to me.
And look, if it had to happen to someone, at least it's happened to someone who's really quite a bloody good writer. if I may be so bold.
Well, if it had to happen to someone, at least it happened to me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like I sit here seething with jealousy, yeah. But it's well-meaning jealousy.
And lots of my friends who are really, really experienced, I've done like Star Wars stuff. Mm. Are desperate to kind of tap into Star Trek, and they're just not able to get in, and they hate my guts.
good.
And I put their names forward again and again and again, but it's one of those things, just very few slots these days and a lot of people chasing them, and I just happen to be in on the ground, so yeah, go me.
Brilliant. And it's fantastic, obviously, because like there is, you know, there's the novels that back there, I think The Neverending Sacrifice, that was mid-2000s, is that correct, mid to late?
Yeah, it's late, about 2008, I think, something like that. Yeah.
And full disclosure, I have not read The Neverending Sacrifice. Is it the same one Garrick speaks of in the show?
No, it's a different one. You should. It's an absolute banger. It's a great one.
I can say brilliant. Well, you see, I can't say the next one I'm going to mention. I have read, and it was the first one of yours I read. I have read The Last Best Hope.
Oh right, yes. Okay, that's good fun. Yeah. I think Neverending Sacrifice and the most recent one, Second Self, I think are my best. So if you like Cardassians, you'll like Neverending Sacrifice. It's basically a retelling of DS9 from the Cardassian point of view. Sort of. So it's good fun. Yeah, you'll crack through it in a weekend.
Oh, that's great. I can just imagine. It's like, you know, every chapter starts with, have those squatters not left yet?
Yeah, it sort of plays with it's not the one that Garrett talks about, but that appears in it. And the character who's the sort of main character can't stand that book. So, so he can't stand the. So all the way through slagging off The Neverending Sacrifice in a book called The Neverending Sacrifice. It's good fun. Yeah. So, I'll read that one. That's great, that one.
Cool. All right. It's great. Based on what I've read so far, I like your style.
Good.
And then, actually, writer question, how did you find, because you've written things like fan fiction as well, moving into novels, is there a challenge in kind of, is there a house style, for example, that is recommended by the publishers in Star Trek that's, you know, listen, you know, kind of go as crazy as you want. Maybe don't do the last 20 minutes of 2001 A Space Odyssey, but, you know, go as crazy as you like. I presume there are somewhat rules you have to follow, like don't kill Sisko in every book.
Yeah, that basically is it. You know, you can't kind of change canon, as people call it. When the show was off air, or when the shows were off air, I think we had a lot more freedom in terms of events that we could kind of invent. And again, kind of killing off characters to some extent, just because there was nothing to contradict. And it was off air for a pretty long time, if you think about it. I mean, you know, when does Enterprise finish, and when does Disco come back? So we were like pigs in muck. We just had a grand old time, you know. Yeah, let's do it. Whoa, kill him. Whoa, whatever. Because the minute it comes back, all of that has to lock down, because whatever's appearing on screen, it's got to be congruent with that. I mean, that, for example, sort of, I think it's well documented, isn't it, that, you know, Picard comes back and completely contradicts everything established in the books for 20 years, to the great chagrin of us all. And, you know, there was weeping and wailing and grinding of teeth. But, you know, we had a brilliant old time, so you can't complain. So really, those are the only constraints. Don't outright contradict something that's on screen. Unless you've got a really good reason and it's part of the plot. Though I would say that, as I say, now that it's back on screen, probably we're a little bit more constrained in what we're doing. Most usually because they'll come to us and say, we want a prequel to Picard. Okay, all right, that's Last Best Hope. Or we want something that fits in between season 2 and 3 of Discovery. That's Wonderlands. So you're constrained a little more by the projects that they ask you to do. But in terms of house style, in terms of writing style, I've just written in my own style. I'm a lot more, you don't read my books for space battles and that kind of thing, or high action. You read them for kind of introspection and intrigue and character work. So that's what I'm interested in doing. It's what I did in my fan fiction. It's what I do here. And people either like it or they don't. So, you know.
Well, I mean, obviously, and I'm not simply saying this because I'm talking to you right now, but I did quite like it particularly. So Last Best Hope was the first one I read. Mm. And because I had, obviously, we'd done season one of Picard and I, want to see, is there more to the story? And since then, I frequently recommend Last Best Hope because I feel like there's at least a 2 or 3 episode miniseries alone in Last Best Hope. I think it's like, it's quite essential to understanding, for example, where was Geordi in season one? And, we get more of Bruce Maddox and, we get, the Enterprise and things like that. You're ticking all the boxes for the fans and everything. Yeah. But like that as well, there is one amazing cameo, which I won't spoil just in case anyone hasn't read the book. It's toward the end of the novel. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But yes, it's, but as you say, it's not a book that's, kind of like, right, let's get a fleet of Romulan warbirds facing off against everything. It's not that. And I think to the betterment of laying the groundwork for the story, because I understood an awful lot more then of, this is the Romulan Star Empire. You think they could just beam everyone off and, they'd go and kind of, okay, well, I kind of get why that didn't happen then.
Yeah, I mean, they could, but the way the culture worked just meant that they didn't do it. A bit like climate change or world hunger, we could solve those overnight if we wanted. There's loads of food, but people just don't do it.
It is, you're just like, but...
But we could. But
why don't we do... Don't ask such questions.
There's a great TikTok going around by a guy called Vinny, and it's called Earth Applies for Memberships of the Galactic Federation. And it's from the representative kind of going, so I'm interested in all these sort of, one of them is, when there's world hunger, and, logistics. You want me to write logistics? And okay. And that's exactly kind of what it's like in Last Best Hope, I think. I think the Federation is looking at the Star Empire and going, but we could just do this if you weren't all just obsessed with the politics and the secrecy, and that kills an awful lot of people. There you go. Yeah. Happy days.
Yeah. I mean, oh, that's a massively cheerful book as well, of course.
It's a bleak book. People have found it that quite upsetting, actually. There you go.
That's all right. I mean, compared to the laugh riot that was season one of Picard,
exactly. And I think that does end on a positive note. And I suppose you've got to read Last Best Hope thinking, well, that's just the first act.
Yeah.
Or, and you've got to read it with the knowledge that that season of Picard is going to be happening and the ending of that. So it is quite a downbeat book, though. There you go.
It is, yeah. Laughs are thin on the ground, but I think it's essential. In terms of timing, Is it published after the end of season one of Picard, or does it come out before? Sorry, it literally just escaped me there.
Oh, it was quite well timed, actually. The book came out. I think it was between episodes 3 and 4 or 4 and 5. Right. So you sort of got, it was where you got Elnor introduced for the first time, and you would either watch that episode and then open the book and go, oh, right, now I understand this planet and what's going on here. So it was sort of tied to come out alongside that episode, which worked really well, I think. So you could be watching that episode, go, oh, what's happening here? And then kind of pick my book up and very quickly find some backstory out about that. So that's when it was published. It was really well timed.
That makes sense. I could just see, all this audience were like, oh, great, I can't wait to see what other worlds like Vashti there are out there. All right.
Yeah, it's TV's always constrained by budget, isn't it? You just got to imagine that yourself. I mean, my job is imagining what's, beyond the screen. But I think we have to do it as well, don't we, when we view.
I think so as well. Like, it's a bit like, in a way, it's like, remember when we introduced, say, this character who's, they were always there, they were just standing just off screen.
Just there. Yeah, just, were, not here, just there.
Yeah. It's like, good old, like Lieutenant Jim, I don't know,
Or people on DS9 that you never see, like Lieutenant Vilix Pran, the one who buds. you know.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, actually, yeah, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Or we know there must be a counsellor. We think there must be a counsellor before Esri and this kind of thing. So I spent a lot of time imagining other inhabitants of space time, probably more than is good for me. So,
But hey, it's good because it just helps to flesh it out, because there's got to be more than seven people running this station, including the bar, including security. You know, you're kind of
exactly
like,
that,
surely.
Yeah. There's going to be beta shift, isn't there, or the equivalent?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And of course, you know, the oft mentioned, never seen Baudet with his transparent skull.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I imagine, like, you know, in Shaun of the Dead, where they pass a bunch of other people who are having look exactly the same and having a more competent adventure. I imagine that there's the kind of night shift on DS9 doing the same. You know, God, they get like, you know, attacked by par wraiths and all we're doing is shipping manifests. It's a very boring Deep Space Nine.
Then you have someone who's just like, I mean, I do want my life to be more exciting, or do I?
Do I? Hmm.
It's like, you know,
exactly that.
Now, I'll come back to Star Trek again in a second, but also, I mean, you've written for Doctor Who, you've written for Firefly, you've mentioned obviously Blake 7 as well. Now, as I say, I am a Whovian. So this is even cooler.
I think there's a cream for that, you know.
I keep applying. It ain't working.
It's not worked. No. They get you young.
I think that's it. Yeah, once they get you. So I know, so you've written for Big Finish as well, and you've written novels. So, I mean, what do you prefer, Star Trek or Doctor Who?
I prefer Blake 7.
That is a very diplomatic answer. I like that very much.
I would have to say Deep Space Nine. That's really where my heart is. So, and bring it on. I don't care.
No. My series has always been DS9. That's the one that
exactly
got me.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think for people who imagine it's got the most seeds.
It's simultaneously absolutely perfect and at the same time broken in ways that series television always is. So you're constantly going, I love this so much and I just want to fiddle with it a little bit, or I want to expand it here and there and there. And the best thing is I got to do that for my job.
I just imagine, you know, say one of the many writers who were on it originally just kind of come along and pick up the book and just like, oh crap, she's done it better than we have.
I don't think so. No. TV writing's so hard. I'd hate to do it. It's really, I don't know how they make so much Doctor Who. You can see why they take these big breaks, because it just eats ideas. And you think they were, Deep Space Nine and the other shows, they're putting out 26 episodes a year. I mean, my God. You know, no wonder you end up with the occasional imprison your clothes or real turkeys. Yeah, I the amount of stuff, and I just have to think up a book occasionally. But they're having to. I'm watching Elementary at the moment, which is great show with John Lee Miller, and the standard is so high, episode by episode. Again, you think they're doing maybe 26 episodes a year. And how are they coming out with all these plots? Just, it's incredible. I guess they've got like a writer's room. You're just throwing ideas at each other and just, you know, your eyes are constantly looking into newspapers going, I can get a story out of that. But if I had to choose, I'd say Deep Space Nine was my favorite, or Blake 7, which was my first love. So that's the diplomatic answer.
I love that because for me personally, DS9, and for my buddy Ian, Blake 7. He would be delighted to hear that. So
quite right. Gentleman and a scholar.
Excellent. Cool. So Doctor Who being terrible, what brought you to Doctor Who?
Oh, I don't know. I must have needed the money. Yeah. So, obviously I watched Doctor Who as a kid. I loved it very, very much and enjoyed it very, very much. And I'd been doing Trek books for a while and Doctor Who had come back and I thought, I wouldn't mind a crack at that. So I sort of I wrote to the guy who I knew was the consultant on the book range at the time. That was somebody called Justin Richards. And I'd built up quite a good CV by then. And I said, I'd just really like to have a go. And he said, yeah, okay. There we go.
All right, so
I had a little crack. And I think that was, what was that called? King's Dragon. So that would have been
Eleventh Doctor.
Yeah, I think I knew that we were due a regeneration. So I think we knew that Tennant was going, and I thought this is a good time to kind of get in on the ground because they'll be looking for people to do books. So the books as they were at the time, I think they did maybe 3 or 6 a year, and because the show was again a family show, I think the new adventures and so on are pitched at a much older audience, but these are firmly pitched at kind of 8 to 14. So it's really good fun. It's kind of writing, I guess you call it middle grade fiction. So not very long, maybe 50,000 words. And a kid could read alone, but it'd be fun for an adult to read as well. So that's kind of the idea of them. And again, you know, I mean, I've done 3 or 4, but you're constantly going, God, it's really hard thinking up something that hasn't been done before on Doctor Who.
That's really difficult. 60 years of history. I mean, we find ourselves, we're kind of like going, God, wouldn't it be ridiculous if that happened? Oh, yeah, no, that's the twin dilemma. It happened in the 80s.
They've done that one already. We must be due another Atlantis, I would have thought, but we'll see.
Oh, surely. Sure. We got the Sea Devils back.
So you can see, I don't know. You think how many scripts people like Russell T. Davis or Stephen Moffat, Chibnall have written. You think, oh, my God, how are you constantly coming up with ideas? So no, television, not for me.
And then of course, as you mentioned earlier as well, there's the big dreaded C word, canon.
There is no canon in Doctor Who. That's official, isn't it? That's the line. Yeah, if it suits the story, chuck it out.
Yep. I mean, perfect. Quite right. Honestly, 60 years of history, let's just do that one. You know, you didn't like it, alternate universe, it's fine.
Exactly that. I think you can't be, it would just become unwatchable. I think Rose proved that. It's a madman in a box. It's somebody running around in a box, going through space and time with a friend. And that's all you need, ultimately. That's got to be about.
That's it, because like imagine a universe where, let's say, everything was rigid, like, and you know, you know the whole kind of like, you know, if you sneeze in the past and it creates a hurricane, yeah. You know, something like, I mean, the Doctor's the greatest criminal that all of time and space has ever known. He's just running around just changing things, you know, or as he said, it was saving the little people.
Yes, exactly that. The opposite of the Prime Directive in many ways. So, once the Doctor's there, are we still saying she? I guess no. We've had the regeneration, haven't we? We're back to he again.
Doctor.
Either way.
It's funny now, kind of not sure what date this is airing on, but as of recording, we are still very much just looking forward to the 60th. The trailer's dropped, you know, looking forward to seeing where we're going.
Yeah, can't wait. It's going to be, it's coming around soon, isn't it? You look and it's 2023 all of a sudden.
Right. You're kind of the most disturbing thing, I think, is that I remember vividly watching the 50th anniversary in the cinema, what feels like last week.
Well, I vividly remember the 50th because my daughter was due on the date of the 50th. In the event, she came a little bit early, and we watched the McGann webisode on the maternity ward. So that was her first doctor. So I can't believe it's 10 years.
Okay, that's a bit special, though, in fairness.
Yeah, that's I remember being on a panel at a convention once, and I think it was a panel Paul Cornell was doing at Gallifrey, at Galley, and it was, you know, what's the most hardcore thing that you've ever done to watch an episode of Doctor Who? And I let everyone else speak, and I said, yeah, well, none of you have been smacked out of your head on morphine recovering from a C-section and watching the McGann webisode on your phone. Yes, none of us. Yes, you take that one away. So that's my most hardcore Doctor Who viewing experience, I think.
I mean, that's it. I mean, you know, I kind of don't want anyone to top that one. I'd be worried what they'd have to do.
And as we've already established, I can't stand this show.
Dreadful show. Only exacerbated by the fact that, you know, a C-section. I mean, if you were ever going to put two things together,
morphine was a necessity.
I'm sure now, you know, if you ever catch yourself, you know, and you turn around, there's Paul McGann standing there, just say, the last time I watched you, I had so much morphine running through my system.
Exactly. Oh my God, it helped. No, does it? No, I love that episode. I think it's absolutely smashing. So
it is. It's so fun. It's well timed as well, because I just want to welcome to the podcast Paul McGann. No.
Oh, don't tease me. That's not fair.
Oh, he's a bit, but even going back even one before Paul McGann, I see as well that you might have to explain this one to me. A monograph on the Curse of Fenric. Now
that's right.
What is that?
Right. Okay. So monograph is an academic study written by a single person, single authored academic study, I think. Well, I've always understood it to be. And there's a wonderful little independent publisher called Obverse, and they publish a series called The Black Archive. And they are short books on individual Doctor Who stories. So they got in touch with me, and I said, okay, well, if I'm going to write a really long essay, if I'm going to write a master's thesis, basically, on a Doctor Who story, it's got to be Curse of Fenric, because that's my favourite. It's my top, well, in my top three, top five. top five. But mostly I thought there was loads of really interesting stuff to say about it. So I got dug into that. It ended up as one of their shorter ones, but that's just the way. I was also really late with it. They were so patient with me. They were absolutely great. But it turned out pretty well. I'm reading Frank Collins's book on Kinder at the moment, which is another one for the Black Archive, and another one of my top fives. So they're beautiful books. They're so beautifully produced and designed. And then it just goes really in depth onto one story. And I think what's really good is that because they have so many different authors, they're not all the same. So it's not like you open it and go, oh, here's the kind of, you know, here's the chapter about this, the chapter about that. They're all what the individual author wants to bring out about that book. So mine goes into a load of stuff about feminist science fiction and all these kinds of things and storytelling and this kind of thing. Whereas others, I think, are more production focused and do a sort of deep dive into that. So they're all great. They're all there's about 60 of them now. I've read about 10 or 12, I think. So I'm kind of slowly, I'm sort of picking my favorite episodes and I will go back and read more of them just because they're just so interesting. And to get to kind of deep dive on a story like that, it's just really good fun. So they're lovely. If you haven't read any of them, sort of pick a favorite story and see if they've done it and have a look. Yeah.
Well, I think I will most definitely start with The Curse of Fenric, of course.
Of course, actually.
Especially now that we have, we have Ace back, as far as we
know.
Yeah.
It was really exciting. It was just, oh, her and Tegan. I loved that episode. I thought it was
really enjoyed
great.
It.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It just a really good, I just uncomplicatedly enjoyed it. So, great to see them back. And then that whole final scene with them all. Oh, my God, there's William Russell. Oh, dear. I know. What trooper.
Fair play, William Russell.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't do that at 50. Never mind, you know, 90, whatever he is.
Yeah, like, you know, I think he did break all sorts of records, I think, in terms of appearances. Good on him. Although it breaks the canon of what, you know, Sarah Jane said about there's a couple, you know, Ian and Barbara who don't age, you know. So obviously the Doctor got really annoyed at Ian and Barbara at some point.
Yeah.
I took that away. It's like,
took a kind of aging ray at them or something.
Yeah. It's like, oh dear. Oh, okay. Well, the Doctor's a complicated figure.
Harsh. Yeah.
I have to ask you about your autobiographies. So, I mean, obviously, I know you've done the autobiography of Spock and the autobiography of Janeway. Now, I have I have read the one for Janeway. I have not yet read the one for Spock. I am a terrible podcast host and I have not done my due diligence and I will be chastised later on. Absolutely. So I do apologize.
All you have to do is buy them.
Fair.
I don't care if you read them. Well, no, obviously I would love you to read them, but
absolutely cool. So everyone listening to this, remember, go out and buy all of them. Buy them. Can gather dust if you want, but
whatever.
Was this something, was this a commission or was this, you know, something that you were like, no, I want to do this project? And did you come to Star Trek with this project?
So that they came to me. So so they're published by Titan rather than Simon & Schuster. For some reason, Titan have got the license to do non-fiction. And these, for some reason, count as non-fiction because they're autobiography.
I mean,
you can kind of see it from a certain angle. Anyway, you know, as you say, fair play. So they'd done two already. They'd done Picard and Kirk, if I remember correctly. And they wanted to do Janeway. And I think the thinking kind of went, we should probably get a woman. Una's a woman.
I can just imagine the whiteboard and it's just got two things on it. Woman.
Who are the Star Trek novelists who are women? Well, there's Kirsten Beyer, who's busy, you know, co-creating Picard, and there's me. So I was the one with the spray. Of course, Kirsten's done all the Voyager books as well, so but she's far too busy writing actual Trek. So they came to me and I said, yeah, absolutely. I hadn't watched Voyager pretty much since it was on, so because I'm a Deep Space Nine, I'm a Niner, so I had to do a really in-depth, quite fast rewrite. It's a real immersive sort of 9 weeks kind of, oh god, I've forgotten this one sort of thing. Had a really deep rewatch, and then did the book, and I made it quite I really wanted to capture her voice. I wanted it to feel like you were sitting down having coffee with her and she was telling you her life story, you know, and there'd be lots of laughs and tears and this kind of thing. It's partly, I sort of thought of her as being quite a prominent public figure. So she's controlling the narrative as well in some way. So, you know, she's making clear that her version of events gets out there. But it was really good fun. And then during lockdown, Kate Mulgrew recorded the audiobook, which is pretty special. So,
I mean, I was going to say, you were talking about, you know, capturing the voice, and it is, I did the audiobook of it. So, I mean, it is an afternoon with Janeway.
Good. That's how it should feel. It should feel like, there's an audience with X. It should feel a bit like that. So I hope she enjoyed reading it. I hope it sort of chimes with her. She seems to have really enjoyed doing it. So it was just really good fun. And then to get, we weren't expecting the audiobook at all. And it was one of those things in lockdown, you know, people, right at the start of lockdown, access just, you know, there's no theatre, there's no, nothing was in production. Let's do some audiobooks. So it was brilliant. So really good fun.
it was fantastic because, I mean, going through it as well, I like how you definitely fleshed out the backstory, things we'd heard, you know, snippets of throughout the series, like that, the Al-Batani, the Billings. There, I'm just testing myself here. I was like, oh, what were they?
Well done. I'm not sure I could have conjured that up.
So I'd love to say, like, you know, all just in the background. No, I've used them for tie quiz questions or tie break questions in quizzes.
Well done. Well done.
Yeah. And I very much liked the development of the Paris Janeway relationship. I liked that. I thought that was that was a nice decision. You kind of having that tie in with Admiral Paris, because of course he becomes sort of in a surprising way so prominent toward the end of Voyager.
Yeah.
And they're just like, and yet he never speaks to Tom.
Yeah, there's just never, you say, okay, all right, I better explore that. So there'd been a book before, there'd been Mosaic, which had been a similar sort of and we kind of, I sort of read that and I thought, you know, we kind of went back to the publisher and said, you know, guys, we could, am I tied to this? Because there's not much point to my book if we're tied to this. And they kind of went, I think we're just going to have to draw a line under that one because it's published during the run of the show and then the show contradicts it. So we kind of, I tried to sort of weave in bits of it, but not feel tied to it. I felt it had to be my version of this character. And I think these characters are so interesting and so well performed that they sort of sustain lots of different versions of them. So hopefully people enjoyed mine. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think generally, I think the feedback has just been, it was great. We want more. So now it's kind of like, oh, I see autobiography of Spock. Have we approached Zachary Quinto or Ethan Peck at this point?
I've no idea. These things, I'm the last to hear. So.
It's like, you're just the artist. Why would we tell you about what's happening? Tell me.
Well, I'm, of course, they're not by me. I'm the editor of these. So
Of course.
Yeah, they're nonfiction books.
I wonder, like, I suppose, you know, would there be, I mean, there would be a market for it, but for, you know, kind of further down. So obviously Spock, not a captain. Well, yes, he is, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there was just the other day, I think the announcement came out that the Sisko autobiography.
Yeah, Derek Salaratica, really excited about that.
You know, do we then, you know, are we looking at, is it maybe, well, I suppose it is too soon for an autobiography of, say, Michael Burnham, I guess obviously I'm just volunteering your time here, don't mind me, but what about Major Kira? You know,
well, I would love to do a Kira autobiography. I think it'd be absolutely fantastic and really refreshing for me, because I'm usually doing the other side, so I should probably spend more time with Bajorans than Cardassians, who can be a bit, you know, aren't the nicest of people sometimes. I'd love to do one of Kira. Is she technically ever a captain? I'm not sure.
She's a colonel, isn't she? Yeah.
Yeah, but that's in the Bajoran militia. And then I think when she gets that Starfleet commission, I'll show you how nerdy I am. When she's got that Starfleet commission, is she commander? So I don't know. I don't know technically if she's ever a captain. And maybe they want to do Archer with an Enterprise anniversary of this one coming. But I think Kira would be phenomenal, really, really good.
I think so, because I think, and you know, actually, I'd love to hear all this, because we're both Niners, and I know Nana Visitor has done interviews over the last few years where, I mean, just think about how groundbreaking the character of Kira is.
Yeah,
you know, you have this former self-admitted terrorist working to build this stronger Bajor. I recently rewatched the episode The Darkness and the Light. She's not exactly saying sorry either.
No, she's not sorry at all. She doesn't regret anything she did to liberate Bajor. So I think I know DS9 people weren't fond of those earlier seasons at the time. Like, oh, it's so much better when Worf arrives, and oh, it's so much better when the Dominion War arc starts. But you go back and look at some of the, we watched it all again in lockdown, and some of the stuff they're trying to do with Bajor is actually really interesting. It's incredible it got brought. He couldn't make that show post 9/11. Couldn't do it now. And it's just so interesting what they try and do. So I'd love to sort of go and give that a really good go. And where she ends up, kind of, you know, trying to liberate Cardassia.
I know.
Those prophets are hilarious. Oh, they're funny guys, those prophets.
They were like, you know, they decided one Tuesday, a fleeting thought. They actually decided thousands of years beforehand. You'll be funny. This will be gas.
This will be great. Let's stick her there with Garak and Damar and see what happens. that's something I'd love to write a book about, actually. If I had a chance, I'd love to do a full-length book about the Cardassian resistance. I'd love to do that, Kieran, Garak and Damar.
That would be fascinating, because I know, obviously, Andy Robinson did the
Stitch in Time.
Thank you. Completely flat my mind there. Which kind of deals with sort of both before and after the war. But there is only what we've seen on screen, really.
I think you could get a novel out of that. I gather that's going to be an audiobook as well. He's reading it. So that's hooray, at last. It's going to be great. Yeah. And the other book I'd love to do, this came out of the Spock autobiography, I'd love to do Spock on Romulus. I really enjoyed writing those sections. I had to really pare them back, actually. I probably had a trilogy in my head. I was like, God, I could spend ages doing this. But I'd love to do that. I think it'd be a really interesting book. So those are the ones I'd like to do. Kira, Cardassian Resistance, and Spock on Romulus. If anyone's listening and commissioning.
So, dear Simon and Schuster and Secret Hideout and whoever has the license at this moment, like, as you know, like, and you know, there's now so much space because obviously with the return of Picard, you know, our lovely Admiral Paris ended up in Star Trek Destiny, and you know, things like this, and then of course Star Trek Coda came along, and obviously there's been a lot of discussion about Coda, and I haven't spoken to the other ones. I understand why, and God bless the people who had to tidy that up.
Oh my God, those lads! Oh blimey, yeah, I know. I couldn't have done it. It kind of broke my heart. I did have a sort of third Garrett book planned, but not to be. A lot of it went into Second Self, so you know, it worked out okay. But yeah, they did a great job, incredible job.
Now, like, in theory, do you get to start again? Just kind of like rewrite the same book again? Just be like, no, it's in the new continuity. There we go.
Absolutely. Well, Second Self is a bit like that, because I kind of, you know, I don't want to spoil it if people haven't read it, because there's stuff in it. But there was bits where I went, oh, yeah, I don't actually have to do that, do I? Because, no, that doesn't happen anymore. But I'm held to a bit like it. So, you know, if you knew those books, then you go, oh, that's a bit alienating and uncomfortable. So it was all good fun. So it was very liberating. It's kind of, all right, I'm just free of all that now. I can just write a story.
God, that's it's fascinating to be like, you've been one of the, you know, the biggest voices in building this world, and then you get to go again, and that is amazing.
Yeah, and there was so much stuff. I mean, I couldn't keep up with lots of it. So that's why I always did Cardassia books, so I knew what was happening there. I got a rough idea what's going on. But just to be free, I wonder if the other guys feel this as well, whether they feel sort of liberated from all that stuff that we'd invented. How to ask them. Bit of a wrench, though. I mean, you're like, oh, you know, but then you just have to clear the decks and go for it.
I could just imagine the meeting, like, you know, okay, everyone come in. Listen, Una said we're just scrapping this novel universe. So if you could just do that over the weekend.
It wasn't me.
Yeah, she's got to write the last best hope. So if you can kind of get on that now, because we need book to come out.
Rather sweetly, Coda ties into Last Best Hope. Have you got to the end of Coda yet? I don't know.
I haven't.
Right, so I'm not spoiling anything, but there's a scene where somebody starts typing. And it's the opening of Last Best Hope. So it's really, really beautiful. I was really touched when it's in Dave Mack's book. It was absolutely lovely. So it's a sort of bridge between that universe and the one that's being now written. So it's lovely.
I love that. I suppose
gorgeous.
For long-term readers, great. We see, there is, you know, there's this one. And also, like, you know, it's like, hey, you know, we're all still working in the same universe. Okay, exactly, now it's just on this part of it.
Yeah, exactly that. Absolutely beautiful. Very clever by Dave Mack. I was very touched by it too.
Excellent. So we got Second Self is out. And so Second Self, this is where does this fall now in the timeline of where we are?
So that is between season one and season two of Picard. So it sort of picks up with Raffi trying to pick up her life again. Have you read it yet? I won't go into spoilers. I won't go into spoilers anyway, just in case. Yeah.
No. In fact, the one I've done between seasons one and season two is the audio drama that starred Michelle Hurd and Jerry Ryan.
Is that No Man's Land?
No Man's Land. Thank you. Yeah. That's the very one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's sort of the same sort of space, but Seven isn't in this book. It's about Raffi trying to make decisions about her life and where she wants to live and how she wants to live, and should she go back to Starfleet Intelligence? Picard's trying to get her to go. So he's going to the academy. Come with me and be a teacher. And she thinks, oh, I can't quite decide what to do. And he says, okay, do one more mission and see whether intelligence work is what you want. So she goes off to this world where there's a kind of Romulan refugee crisis. but she's also trying to track down a Cardassian war criminal that the Bajorans are looking for. So this is kind of her secret mission. And who better to take on a secret mission than Elnor, who, of course, couldn't keep a mission secret if his life depended on it. So so that's the kind of gang. It's Raffi and Elnor go off on a mission to track down a Cardassian war criminal.
Okay, well, I'm already sold because I love Raffi. I love Elnor. And my heart's broke that we've no Elnor in season 3.
I know, that lovely boy. Yes, but Space Legolas.
Space Legolas. Yeah, I mean, yes.
Yeah, I could. I'd happily see more of him. Yeah, and all that new cast actually, Cristobal, Rios, and Jurati. I really like those characters. Of course, I spent a lot of time with them, sort of, you know, doing the books and so on. But Raffi really is Raffi's the protagonist. And there's another point of view character as well, but I won't say who that is because that's a spoiler. Yeah.
Do we think Raffi's gonna get to because Raffi's totally vindicated, so is Gabe ever gonna come around and be like, sorry mum?
Well, I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, they might take it there, you know, because at the end of the day, she, even though she's right vindicated, she chooses to put this obsession ahead of her relationship with her son, which would be a very difficult thing to come back from, I think. And then it's complicated by her kind of, you know, her addiction and what that means and the kind of ravages that would cause on any set of relationships. So I think it's very, very, I mean, I'd like to see some sort of rapprochement, but it depends where the show takes it. But hard to cut, even though she's vindicated, it's made her do some pretty hopeless things. And that really is what Gabe can't forgive, that proving herself right was more important than just going, let's forget it, I'm just going to be here and now. And that's what Gabe can't forgive, I think. Well, that was my sense of it.
Well, no, I get it, because you see that breakdown, particularly in The Last Best Hope, of her relationship. And, you know, it's... You do feel this frustration toward Gabe, but then you're very right. I mean, it's, you know, you don't have to imagine how would you feel to be on the receiving end of, oh, look, mum was here for 5 minutes this week. That's nice.
And it's always something else. I was writing it, this book, on a very tight deadline across the summer holiday, rather than hanging out with my little girls. I was kind of channeling some of them. Absolute guilt. Okay, mummy's got to get some words down on the page, darling. Go and, you know, play with the knives, you know. No, not the knives. No, it wasn't quite that bad, but I was, you know, I was in, it was a chunk of a holiday, and I was kind of stuck writing this, and I think she gets, she's sort of saying, well, just, and I'm just, and maybe she doesn't do it in consultation with her husband as well. There's a sort of, oh, now you're telling me you're doing another 6 months. Some of what we see in Second Self, I think I kind of, we go back to even earlier in that relationship and see how perhaps it was never a good relationship for either of them. They're kind of maybe enabling each other to do more and more risky things. So you see it's kind of a faulty relationship at root in Second Self. But yeah, there's always something that takes priority over Gabe, and Gabe knows it. And I think that's quite hard to come back from. Yeah,
it is. In a way, I suppose that's kind of... It thematically, it's kind of how the message of Trek has maybe changed from, say, the 90s or maybe late 80s, 90s, where everyone gets along really, really well and everyone is the best of friends, and the only people we really are annoyed at are maybe those annoying Klingons or anything.
Yeah.
And of course, by the time you get to Picard, you get slightly more realistic depictions of, you get interpersonal conflict. Obviously, DS9 did do that, probably why we liked it so much. And, you know, it is a bit more realistic, because I guess if this was, say, a season 3 episode of The Next Generation, and you find out that Raffi is estranged from her son, that would be wrapped up by Act 4.
Exactly. Yeah. And it, in a way, I think it's, you know, it's probably more true to what Trek was originally, because you'd think about the original series, Spock and McCoy are you know, constantly bitching at each other. Absolutely. And then think of the movies as well. And, you know, Kirk is estranged from his son. He doesn't know he has a son. For whatever reason, she's decided she doesn't want him involved in her son's life. So I think it's possibly closer to authentic Trek than I know the new shows get a bit of a kicking for, you know, they're not utopias or these sorts of things. So I think probably some of that is always already there.
I know that recently sometimes McCoy gets, you know, apparently DeForest Kelly, nicest man that ever lived.
Yeah.
And people
yeah,
are like, McCoy's a bigot and he's always horrible to Spock and everything. It's like, yeah, but he's funny.
I know. He's one of the best bits to write in the Spock book, actually. He's a hoot. And Spock kind of being very dry. Because the thing that really came out from writing that Spock book is that Spock is really funny. You just don't. Yeah. You kind of blink and you miss it. And a lot of it is undercutting McCoy. And then at the end of the book, McCoy is when Sarek is dying. No, it's when his mother is dying, actually, I think. McCoy is absolutely there for him. He's just, you know, he's just there. So so he's a great character, McCoy. But yeah, he's awful Spock.
But in the same way that, yeah, as friends do. You know, we bully each other, but you know, but if anyone else tries to bully you, I will.
Yeah, exactly.
No. Yeah. That's not okay.
Exactly that. Yeah.
So you've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much. Now I'll
My
come
pleasure.
Up toward the last couple of questions. Now the first question is sort of what is next for yourself? You know, what's in the pipeline? What can we expect from 2023?
Oh, crumbs. I should have checked. I've just finished rewrites on a novel. I'm not sure it's been announced yet, but so I better not. I think it's been announced, but I'm not sure. So I probably better. But there will be a novel coming out in a franchise that I have worked in before. So it's people sort of start guessing about that. And then I've got some audios coming. I've just had a Torchwood audio announced, which is very exciting. So not my first Torchwood. I did a Victorian Torchwood before. And then I think everything else is under wraps.
That's nice and mysterious.
There is stuff, but you get into ever so much trouble if you pre-announce. So I better not risk it.
that is great. That's great. So just for my final question, I'm sure everyone listening to this wants to reach out and get in touch and find you. Where is the best place to do that on this interwebs thing?
On the interwebs. Well, always I used to say Twitter, which I'm still sort of around on. I'm now on Mastodon as well, just under my own name. So I'm very findable online if people sort of want to, you know, come and chat to me. I've got a newsletter as well. You can find it on my website, shunamccormack.com. So very, very findable if you listened to me and thought, yes, I need more of that content in my life, then you can easily come and find more of this nonsense. So
Excellent. Now, the last question, nice and easy, no thought necessary. What does Star Trek mean to you?
Garrick.
Brilliant. Oh, brilliant. Oh, do you know what? In fact, perfect answer.
Yes. It's just the answer, isn't it? So there you go.
Dr. Una McCormick, thank you so much for joining me this evening. You are wonderful. I am, as I say, seething with jealousy in the nicest possible way. and congratulations on everything so far. And I can't wait to read what's next.
That's really kind. Thanks ever so much. It was really good fun. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay. To everyone who's listening, thank you so much. We will, of course, be back next week with another episode of You're on Crackmate. In the meantime, I've been Sean. You've been awesome. Live long and prosper. Bye.